Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We're here today with Justice Jeff Boyd from the Supreme Court of Texas. Welcome, Judge.
Great. Thank you. Good to be here.
We're so glad to have you here. So this is a brand new podcast about Texas appellate law, and we thought that it would be great for our listeners to hear from some of their Supreme Court justices, and you were so grateful to agree to accept our invitation to join up with us today. Maybe it would be helpful just to kind of set the stage to tell the listeners a little about yourself. Most of them will know you, I hope. But one thing I thought might be interesting is just to remind folks how you got on the court and what your experience was before you joined the court.
Well, sure. Yeah. So I've been on the court now since December of 2012. So a little over 8 years on the court, I guess, or coming up on eight. At the time, I was serving as chief of staff to Governor Perry. Before that, I had spent 8 years at Thompson & Knight in the Austin office and then left and spent 3 years as head of civil litigation for John Cornyn when he was attorney general. Went back to Thompson & Knight and was there another 8 years and then left in 2011 to become general counsel to then Governor Perry at the governor's office. And about 8 or 9 months later, became his chief of staff, and so I was serving as his chief of staff for, 15, 16 months when he appointed me to the court in December of 2012.
Now, we hope that most of our listeners are pretty familiar with the Texas Supreme Court, but Texas does have kind of a unique court system where the Supreme Court isn't supreme for everything. Can you just kind of tell us about the Supreme Court's role in the Texas judiciary?
Sure. Well, for one thing, I always host these tour groups that come in, and a lot of them are like fourth grades and seventh grade when they're studying Texas history. And I always tell them to imagine like the old historic courthouse down in New Braunfels or Williamson County or whatever. And picture is a three-story building, and all of your trial courts are on the first floor. And if you don't like what happens there, you can go to the second floor, and that's where you find your courts of appeals. And then if you don't like what happens there, you can go up to the third floor. But that we're unique in Texas because when you get off the elevator on the third floor, there's two courts up there. So there are two highest courts in Texas. One is our court, and the other is the Court of Criminal Appeals, so that if it's a criminal case, even though you will be in the same district court in some counties, and you'll be in the same court of appeals, when you get to the third floor, you go to one court or another. If it's criminal, you go across the hall. Everything else comes here. So that's one limitation. Texas and Oklahoma are the only courts, states that have twin high courts. So that's the biggest limitation on what we do. And then we've got kind of jurisdictional limitations in terms of the kinds of cases that we are allowed to hear, although those limitations are pretty, the boundaries are pretty gray on that. If it's important to the jurisprudence, we have jurisdiction to hear it, and we get to decide what's important to the jurisprudence. So,
right. I remember that was a fairly recent change.
Yeah.
There used to be a list of about five or six things that the Supreme Court had jurisdiction of, and then they were all consolidated into the what was already there, right? The
right.
Importance to the jurisprudence of the state.
Yeah, that's right. And so you had all these other optional hoops you could jump through, or you had to jump through. And so you had all this block copying going on in these opinions where from one to the next would be like, okay, are we going to go under door A or door B or door C? Well, we're going to go under door C. So find the last opinion we wrote that said we're going under door C and block copy that because honestly, those didn't necessarily impose much more of a limit than the general important to the jurisprudence. In terms of practically speaking, the court could almost hear any case. Now, there were some limitations, for example, some interlocutory appeals and others where you had to show a conflict between the two, between two or more courts of appeals. And that you couldn't make it up. You had to actually have a conflict. But defining conflict became a little creative, I think, in some for the court on some occasions.
Your point actually raises a question for me. Having handled a number of matters in your court and seen how some folks in their petitions for review, you've got to have the jurisdictional statement in there. And I still see from time to time people arguing about whether a case is important to the jurisprudence of the state, right, and actually making more or less a legal argument in that section of the brief. How does the court view that?
Honestly, if we're talking about brief, now in the petition is one thing, brief's another, only because I am almost certainly not to read it in your brief. By the time we're getting briefs, I'm not concerned. I want to hear your argument. So don't put your argument in the jurisdictional statement and not in the argument part, because it may get overlooked, right? In the petition, I'll definitely read it. I read the petitions, but it's not unusual to see a 3-page or more statement of jurisdiction trying to argue why this is important. I think that's to me, it's not effective. I'm not going to read all that. It may be that this is important to because the Court of Appeals opinion undermines the clear law of the state that it's, the court is finally developed to the point it is, and now it undermines it. Or it may be it's important because it creates a conflict. Or maybe it's important because it's a brand new statute and we really need to hear the court's view on it, or whatever. You can say that in a paragraph, and I would definitely encourage advocates to say it in a paragraph.
And you've kind of mentioned it. There's two different steps to get to the Supreme Court. You have the initial petition for review, which is the one that kind of tells the court why they should take the case. And then there's the brief on the merits that tells the court, here's why the Court of Appeals got it wrong or why they got it right, depending on which side you're on. Mm-hmm. It sounds like maybe there are different things you look for in each one or different parts that you kind of focus on. What do you do when you're looking at a petition or a brief on the merits? What's your process?
Yeah, well, of course, you guys know this. Maybe not everybody does, but certainly everybody that knows how this court operates knows. The petition, all you're trying to do is get us interested in the case. And in fact, lots of people think the real purpose of the petition is to convince us to grant the petition and hear the case. Honestly, the purpose of the petition, as we currently do things, I think should be to convince us to want to study the case. Because as you know, the first step is after we get the petition, before we grant, we're going to ask for full briefs on the merits if we think it's worth studying the case. And when those briefs come in, one of the law clerks will prepare a full-fledged study memo circulated to all 9 members of the court, not just for their judge, but for the whole court. And that study memo is going to really flesh out what's argued in the briefs. And so the petition, you just want to get us to that point, because then you get to file your brief and then we'll make the decision whether to grant or not. So really the petition, you just want to focus on, it takes 3 votes in most cases to get us to ask for full briefing and do a study memo. And you just want to get our attention enough to get 3 people to say, yeah, we should look at this more.
And that's really a function, too, of the word count limitation in the petitions, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I find that that's really all I have time to do in a petition is try to get you interested, get the Supreme Court interested. You mentioned 3 votes to request briefs on the merits, but I know in talking and preparing a little for this episode, I believe there have been some instances in which the court has skipped past filing their asking for a response, I should say.
So we asked for full briefs, even though we did not ask for a response?
This has never happened to me. This is really Jody's topic. I'm going to throw it out there.
That actually happened recently. We had several parties had filed petitions on a number of things, and the court sent us an order and said, instead of responses, we just want to go straight to briefs, set up an agreed briefing schedule and send it to us and we'll enter the order. Is that something that may be happening more commonly now? It's the first time that it ever happened to me.
I don't remember that case. I'm sitting here now, and if I knew which one it was, I could look it up and would know and could tell you maybe even why we did that. And I sitting here, I don't remember what that is, but it seems to me if you're the respondent, you'd sure like a chance to come back and say, you shouldn't even make us do full briefs, right? Because, I mean, I was a practitioner before. I mean, I argued numerous cases in this court. And what always made the client the most angry was having to pay a lawyer to write a full brief, and then it gets denied anyway. Or even if you're the respondent, to write a full brief, only to have it denied. On the other hand, if we're really interested in it, and we know we're really interested in it, we're going to look at that. I don't know what your case was, but there are some that are obviously study cases. I mean, we're going to do a study memo in this case. Why make your client pay you to do a response that we're just not going to, we're still going to study the case, whether you do, no matter how you respond. So maybe that was our thinking. I don't know. I don't remember that ever happening, but I don't dispute that it may have, but it would be unusual. We certainly wouldn't grant a case without hearing from you. And that's sort of the fundamental rule is we're not going to grant a petition and agree to hear a case without giving you a chance to respond. I guess the thinking on that would have been, well, by asking for a full brief, you've responded, right? It's interesting because practitioners know, the ones who are here often, they know that when we ask for full briefing, I think, Todd, you just said the difference between a petition and a full brief is in the petition, you want to convince us why to take the case, whereas a full brief, the purpose is to convince us the Court of Appeals was wrong if you're the petitioner. But in a sense, and a lot of the advocates get this, we're still trying to decide whether to take the case when you send your brief. So a lot of briefs will start off by saying, you need to grant this case because of all of these reasons. They're still arguing that. And a lot of response briefs will respond and say, you need to deny this case for this reason. So they don't take for granted that we've already decided to grant. We do a lot of study memos. We get a lot of cases where we get study memos, full briefing and study memos, and still deny the case.
Yeah, I think an advocate who knows what they're doing in this court, that advice, I believe, is put forward in the Advanced Appellate Seminar and the UT Appellate Seminar. It's not a gimme at that point. And you right. still, your odds go up.
Right.
Your odds increase as the petitioner of getting your case, your petition granted, but they only go up to about, I think, 1 in 3 or 30, mm-hmm. 30-ish percent. And so, no, I was always under the impression that you might want to argue that the Court of Appeals got it wrong, but you're still arguing about why it's important.
Right.
And that the court should grant it because
that's
it's
right.
not a lay down at that point.
And it's in, I mean, you've got to show, I always tell people there are two factors we're looking at, primarily. Did the Court of Appeals appear to get it wrong? Because if it looks like they got it right, we're much less likely, obviously, to take the case. Occasionally, we'll take one thinking we're going to affirm this, but we need to resolve a conflict between two courts of appeals, and this is the best case to do that in, or whatever. But usually, you got to show us the Court of Appeals was wrong. But the second factor is you got to show us why this is important beyond just the parties to this case. And I would say of the 9 of us, we all, our scales tip slightly differently on that. There are some that if it looks like there was Court of Appeals error, then they're going to want to at least study the case and maybe take it. And the main reason is because we have the per curiam process that allows us to fix error. Now, we're not an error correction court. You still got to show us it's important. But if there's clear error and it's truly unjust, even if it's only important to these parties, there are some on the court who are going to say, let's do a per curiam and fix this, right? Others are going to say, no, it's just not important, and that's just not the kind of court we are. And so it just, you're gonna have that balance. So as a practitioner, you got to speak to both sides of that. You got to get the ones that want to see error, and you got to get the ones that want to see importance.
Right.
And on that topic, you'd mentioned you've got to have 3 votes to get briefs on the merits and issue a study memo. What are the other vote levels that you have to take the case to issue a per curiam?
Well, you're going to challenge me now. What is it?
If you know. If not, we can ask Blake that
course,
question later.
Of course, majority, four to grant, unless it's a mandamus, then five, I guess. Is that right? I think that's right. Four to grant and five for mandamus. Six for the per curiam. Okay. I don't know. I got to go back and look. Todd?
I do not want to correct you,
Judge. I want you to correct me. Here's what's funny about that. I've been on the court 8 years, but you sit there in conference and you take the votes, and you know it takes three for a study memo, four to grant, five for a mandamus?
I guess that begs the question of whether mandamus procedure really differs from a petition procedure.
Well, I guess that's true.
I mean, you'd have to have five to have your majority.
But ultimately, that's what it is, to grant it.
Is it still four to hear it? Because my experience with mandamus is a little different. The courts of appeals treat those, to me, completely differently than the Supreme Court does.
Yeah.
And
the beauty of being on this court and sitting around, whether it's in chambers or in conference, is there are appellate experts all around you all the time. So when you're sitting there at the conference table and you're like, now how many more votes do we need for that? All you got to do is ask, and there'll be seven people who know the answer offhand.
I may be showing my own ignorance, but
I'm showing mine, so that's okay.
I believe that it's seven votes for a PC. I believe. If I'm incorrect on that, I will correct it in the show notes.
Good,
And I will eat humble pie. For some reason, it is stuck in my brain that to issue a per curiam opinion, I
think you are right, because here's the little, people know this, but rarely think of it this way, but I do now. I think you're right. Now that I think about it, because what's unique about a per curiam is that it's going to come out without the author named by the court per curiam, and there'll be no dissenting or concurring opinion. So you think it's unanimous, but it may not be. In fact, we may have internally registered a dissent in conference and said, "Look, I'm not with it. I vote no." And you can have as many, I think you're right, Todd, as many as two people. It could be a 7-2 decision per curiam, but there's no public record of the fact that the vote was 7-2. That's right. And so you got to pick and choose which one of those, because if you're one of the two and you choose, no, I'm going to have to write in dissent on this, well, then it becomes it's no longer a per curiam. The author of the per curiam adds his or her name, and it becomes an authored opinion even without oral argument.
How often does that happen, though, with you have an
rarely.
Authored opinion without oral argument? That's
rarely. Yeah. I would say since I've been here, that's probably happened two or three times in 8 years, if that many, like twice probably.
Yeah. So we know those are former per curiam drafts.
That that's right.
Didn't get the votes.
That's right.
Or they got the votes, but someone decided they were going to write separately.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what kicked it over to a signed opinion.
That's right.
That's wow. Interesting. One thing we were curious about is how cases get to you, to your chambers particularly. You mentioned reading the petitions for review that come across, and I guess mandamuses are probably treated a little differently. I don't know if you see every mandamus petition that comes in or if those are screened initially by the mandamus attorney. But you know, just for the average lawyer who may not know, what is the general process that the court goes through when petitions come in and
right.
how they're circulated? And
so for petitions, they'll all come in through the clerk's office, and the clerk's office will file them, and all the ones that come in, for example, this present week will be batched up as this week's set of petitions. And then it's usually 4 weeks later is the date on which that batch, our votes will be due. So every Thursday at noon, I have to have my votes in on 20 to 30 petitions, motions for rehearing, or petitions for writ of mandamus. So each week, that's a large part. I mean, we'll spend, it can be up to a couple days a week just dealing with that week's set of petitions and getting your votes in by noon on Thursday. Well, that Thursday, when your votes are due, that batch of petitions are the ones that were filed usually 4 weeks earlier, because you've got to give the other side a chance to file a response or waive response. If everybody votes deny, and this is what we call the conveyor belt system, if everybody votes deny, the next day on Friday, it's on orders as denied, right? So that's the conveyor belt is this imaginary picture of all the cases being set on a conveyor belt, and it's the conveyor belt of death or denial, because at the end of it, on that Friday, it's going off unless one of us reaches down and picks it up. And so if even one of us votes to discuss or study that petition, it'll be pulled off the conveyor belt, and it won't be denied that next day. It'll be put on conference agenda. And so then you get to conference, and that's when you have the discussion to see if you can come up with three or more people willing to study it. If you do, then you get the study memos. So at that point, you'll ask for full briefing. So now you're going to be 2 or 3 months later because of the briefing schedule. And then the study memo will be done by one of the law clerks, and then we'll come back at conference and discuss it again. And then it's at that point, usually at that point, when we'll either deny or grant it and agree to hear it. Sometimes we'll have some further study, but it'll be denied or granted at that point. If it's granted, if we have at the end of the day of conference, we've granted 9 or more cases, then Nadine, our administrator, just literally writes the style of a case on a blue index card. And so for each of the 9 or more, we'll shuffle those cards and go down to the end of the table to the junior justice, and now she will pull one blindly out of the stack, and that's the one she's assigned to write the court's opinion in, and then to the next junior justice and so on. And that's how we just randomly divvy up the writing assignments.
Still using old school cards.
Old school cards. It's kind of a fun thing, though. In fact, I still have upstairs in my chambers every blue card that I've drawn. And sometimes it's flipped, right? So you drew it, but what I thought was the right answer, 5 or more disagreed with me. So one of them became the majority writer. I became the dissent writer, but it's still my blue card. I still get, you don't have to give the blue card away when it flips.
So a case gets assigned to you, you take your card back to the chambers. What happens then?
Yeah. So at that point in my chambers is a little unique on this because, I don't know, probably my second or third year, my clerks came to me and they said, Judge, we want to write the first draft of a majority signed opinion, because we weren't, you know, my staff attorney and I were divvying them up to write first drafts. And I was a little hesitant about that, but I thought, okay, I'll let you do it. You get one, and about halfway through the year, we'll pick one and give it to you. But the two rules are, one, I want the draft before oral argument instead of a bench memo. So I want a full-fledged draft for alarm. And two, you got to have thick skin, because the draft two is not going to look anything like your draft. And it just doesn't. If I write the first draft and give it to my staff attorney, her draft two never looks. She wants to make a lot of changes, and they're almost always good. Same thing, vice versa, if I'm the one who looks at her first draft. So it's the same with the law clerks. Well, they agreed to that, and so they did it and did a good job. So that's the practice we've retained. But it also led to my staff attorney. Now, when she does the first draft on a case, she has it by oral argument. So if I've drawn the case, I'm going to come to the bench at oral argument already having a draft. Now, it doesn't look anything like what the final draft's going to look like, but there's value in actually trying to communicate the analysis in writing besides just a bench memo that summarizes the arguments, but actually communicate the analysis in writing. When you sit down, just like writing a brief, trying to communicate to somebody what your thinking is, you know, you're much better in a much better position to know what questions need to be asked, right? So in my chambers now, we get the first draft, unless I'm doing it, we get the first draft before oral argument in every case. That either one of my law clerks or staff attorney is doing. That's not true with everybody, and I don't usually circulate that first draft to the rest of the judges. I just use it for oral argument, and then I'll do some kind of a short post-argument memo to the rest of the court saying, here's where I think we're going. So after oral arguments, the next week usually, we'll sit down in conference and whoever that case was assigned to will say, here's where I think I'm going. And we'll go around the table and get feedback. And you may leave that day knowing that eight people disagree with where you think you're going. And now you've got that, you know, fish or cut bait situation. Are you going to stick with what you think's right, or are you going to go their way? But you've got 2 months now at that point to circulate a draft in a non-expedited case. And so while you're doing that final research and writing to come up with the final draft to circulate, you figure out whether you think they're right or not. And so then you'll circulate your draft before that conference 2 months after oral argument.
So you're not seeing, I guess you mentioned having a draft prepared in advance. I think it's very interesting. Yeah. Are there any other justices who do the same and circulate those drafts
before No, argument? Nobody circulates before oral argument. Occasionally, what you'll – it's kind of fun because typically our oral arguments are all in the same week, Wednesday, Thursday, three or four cases each day, and then a week later on Tuesday we have conference, right? So when you finish your oral arguments on Thursday, now you've got Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday until conference, and the tradition is if it's your case, you'll circulate a memo to the court before conference saying, here's what I'm thinking. We call it a post-sub, a post-submission memo. Now, the chief circulates a post-sub in every case, whether he drew it or not. He circulates a post-sub in every case, which we love. They're great. It may be one paragraph, but it's always, he just loves doing it, and we love getting them. If it's your case, you circulate your post-sub and let them know, here's what I'm thinking. Occasionally, people will circulate a first draft in lieu of a post-sub. And I've done that a few times because I do have a first draft, and sometimes the cases are simple enough you can do that. Honestly, it's one discrete issue, and look, it's either the grass is green or it's brown, and so you just got to make that call and move on. And so occasionally that happens. So I would assume when others do that, they've been working on the analysis at least pretty heavily before you get to oral argument. But I don't know whether any others actually do drafts before oral argument.
Let's switch topics just a little bit. We don't want to keep you here all day, but you know, Supreme Court justices wear different hats. Most of your time is spent with the voting on petitions, opinions, all that kind of stuff. But you do other stuff with regard to the state judiciary. Can you kind of talk about what your roles are and some of the other justices' roles are?
Yeah, sure. So we all have what we refer to as liaison roles, where we serve as liaisons for various organizations. The chief has been the liaison to the Supreme Court Rules Advisory Committee forever. And we also have a deputy liaison to that committee. And I served as that for several years. When Justice Bland joined us last year, she's been a member of the Supreme Court committee even longer than I had been. And I had been since like 01, and she had come on in that. So when she joined the court, I deferred and gave that up and said, look, I don't want her to have to leave SCAC, we call it, Supreme Court Advisory Committee. I don't want them to lose her. I miss it. I mean, I enjoyed SCAC for many years, but I gave her seniority for that. So that's one. But the state bar, Justice Lehrman now is the liaison to the state bar. I'm the liaison to the Texas Young Lawyers Association, so I get the fun events. I've been the liaison the whole time to the Judicial Committee on Information Technology, JCIT, which is the committee that Justice Rebecca Simmons chairs that has overseen the process, at least the recommendations for implementing the process of e-filing and now electronic access through the Research Texas website. They've done a phenomenal job, and it's been a pleasure to be the liaison to that group and a part of what they're doing. I actually have also been the liaison to the Judicial Task Force on emergency preparedness or readiness in times of emergency, which is interesting because when I first joined the court in 2012, got appointed to do that, it was an inactive group and had been since they had first put together, I think Olin Underwood had helped lead a process of putting together a kind of a emergency plan back after the hurricanes in the 90s. And then it was like, well, whatever, you know, there's no, I mean, in the 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s. Well, I called them together and we said, well, but we, you know, even it's when there's no emergency that you need to be preparing for emergency. So let's see what we can do. Well, they did a good job and put together a new report, and we were, it kept getting bumped off our agenda to approve it because there just wasn't any urgency. And we were literally having our big conference in August when the hurricane was hitting down on the Gulf. What was that, 2013 or 14? I don't. Anyway, this decade, the big one. And it was on our agenda, and we didn't bump it that time. We were like, okay, let's do it. Well, now here we are. I don't know if you saw yesterday. So we've got the coronavirus scare, and we're, right. And that can really affect if it turns out to be widespread, and you end up with these situations where you're shutting down businesses and schools because you got to put a stop. It can affect how courts operate. So we've got that plan in place, and we're implementing it. And so that's been fun to do as well. So we've all got different assignments like that.
Well, it's certainly in the news these days, and it's good to know that there is a plan. A lot of work from home kind of arrangement, I would imagine. Yeah. Of course, the court is very well fixed technologically to be able to be remote.
It works for us, but it doesn't work as well for the district court that has a bail hearing or a TRO for domestic violence, or, and so you've got to be in a position for courts to keep operating through whatever the challenge may be, whether the hurricane destroyed the courthouse or you've got a quarantine. So yeah, they are implementing that now.
You know, as we're wrapping up, we kind of hope every episode to maybe end with an anecdote or a war story. Wondered if maybe you had a good one either from practice or your time on the bench that you'd want to just share with the listeners.
Well, my favorite experience being on the court, was the very first week that I had joined the court, and we had oral argument. I was sworn in on, I guess, Monday evening, officially sworn in on Monday evening, and we had oral arguments Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning, and Thursday morning. So, one of those was the infamous dead dog case, which is the case where Strickland v. Medlin, where the, family's pet shelter rescue dog had gotten out during a storm. The dad had gone around hunting for it, finally found it at a shelter late in the day. They needed $45 or whatever to get him out. He didn't have it with them, so he said, hang on, and y'all are about to close. I'll come back in the morning. Well, he goes back with his little boys and shows up the next morning, and they had an employee had put the wrong tag on the cage, and they had euthanized the dog. Terrible case. But the issue was, how do you value that loss, right? Because it's a dog is historically property like this table is. And if you steal my table, we figure out the market value. Maybe we have depreciation or appreciation or whatever. But what is a shelter dog worth to those two little boys, right? And the mom and dad, and I actually have my dog with me upstairs today. So I have Bailiff the Sheepadoodle is my dog.
Bailiff.
I got him the month after I won election in 14, and it seemed like a good name at the time, but it's gotten cornier as the years go by. But anyway, do you get loss of companionship, sentimental value? How do you do this? So it was a really interesting case. We ended up unanimously saying we're not going to recognize a change in the common law that allows you to do that because it's such a policy choice. And in fact, the animal rights groups filed amicus briefs urging us not to allow those kind of damages because it would increase the cost of veterinary care. They'd have to get bigger insurance and all of that. So anyway, but during the oral argument, I asked the lawyer for the plaintiff, well, if we go your way, where do we draw the line? What about cats or fish or birds? And the lawyer gave the answer you would expect, which is, you know, you got to draw the line somewhere, but in the end, the plaintiff has to show that there truly is a sentimental value, and juries are smart enough to figure that out, and blah, blah, blah. It was a good answer, but the next morning, it was such an interesting case, the AP wrote a story that got published in lots of articles, and it basically said the court did not seem inclined to go with the plaintiff's theory here. In fact, new Justice Jeff Boyd asked, where do we draw the line? What about cats or birds or fish? And the next, I guess it was the next day or the or maybe that afternoon, Blake, our law clerk, I mean, our court clerk comes in and calls me and he says, I just want you to know, I just got off the phone with a woman from Fort Worth and spent 45 minutes. She wants to know, she's mad and wants to know why you hate cats. So I learned my first week, you got to be careful the questions you ask because they're going to send a message one way or another, and it may not be the message you you want to send. So,
but for the record, you're okay with cats.
Yeah, I've got a cat that sleeps on my bed every night, so I love cats.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm glad we're able to help you clear the air on that. Justice Boyd, it's been a pleasure to have you. We're so grateful for you taking the time to join us, and just thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Absolutely.
It's been fun to be with you guys.
Thanks
and
for
good
everything
luck with
you
the
do.
Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.